Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We wring our hands in this country over the quality of public education, and we have for a long time now. We go through Sputnik moments and China and India rising panics. We talk about beefing up our STEM courses, science, technology, engineering, math, and fret about teaching to the test. Well, the next big thing in American education is coming down the road and fast. You may never even have heard of it. This hour On Point, the new national standard, the Common Core, and what it means. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Is your child's school, your state, getting ready for the Common Core? Do you even know? Do you like the sound of a clear set of learning expectations for the whole country or not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me first today from Bethesda, Maryland, Catherine Gewirtz, assistant editor and lead Common Core reporter for Education Week. Catherine Gewirtz, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
I know you've been covering this for a long time, but for a lot of people, it feels like it's kind of exploding around them right now, and there's more to come. Can you just lay out for us, what is it? What is the Common Core?
Sure. Yeah, this has been taking shape for several years, and the way standards get enacted explains oddly why a lot of people don't know about them. But to go back to your point about how they got started, it was really an initiative mounted by an organization of the nation's governors, the National Governors Association, and the chief state school officers, which is to say the state school superintendents of all the states. There was an initiative begun in 2009. And they actually had a summit to talk about it. And
about what? You're talking about how it got started. My question is more basic. What is it?
Yeah. Okay. The common standards are essentially academic expectations and goals at a high level, broadly, abstractly, in other words, in English language arts and mathematics. It's not a detailed lesson-by-lesson curriculum. Mm-hmm. They're broad sets of skills. What should your kids know and be able to do in those two subjects?
Okay, so these are expectations out of which have been built or will be built tests to measure whether they've been met or not?
Yes, there is a set of common assessments being designed by two big groups of states, and they're using federal money, race to the top money, which came out of the stimulus legislation, to do that. So they've got $360 million, these two consortia of states, to design sets of shared assessments, common assessments to the states in each consortium that will test students' mastery of the common standards. Of course, between standards and tests lies curricula, and that's where some of the heat is being generated here. Of course, the tests are generating heat, too, many stripes of heat. But the curriculum that goes between the standards and tests, in other words, how do you turn standards into day-to-day instruction, that's going to vary a lot. But one of the fears and one piece of the backlash is it will sort of create a lockstep kind of instruction. There are people who disagree with that criticism, but it is a fear out there.
Is it a federal program, the Common Core?
Officially, no. But there's another stripe of heat here came in on this because the federal government has advocated for them quite heavily and has put money behind it. Whether that amounts to dictating curriculum, there's a real genuine debate about that. There are people who feel that once you fund tests on standards, you're essentially funding what kids are going to get taught in the classroom. So there's real concern about that. The Common Core's advocates think that's unfounded. But what the government did is in its race to the top competition that was aimed at school improvement, one of the things that states could do to earn points in that competition and thus make it more likely for them to get money during a recession, keep in mind, was they could adopt the common standards. They weren't explicitly referred to as the common standards. They were referred to as a set of high, rigorous standards in common to many states. But everyone knew what they were talking about. So there was that piece of the kind of incentivizing by the federal government, and then there was the funding of tests, which those two things combined have created a certain kind of skepticism that this is a sort of a government-driven operation.
Even though it didn't start at the federal level. New York and Kentucky already getting in here. The school year 2014-15 is when it clicks in really big. Take us back for a minute, Catherine. Why did so many governors and chief education officers at the state level think this was important, think it was necessary? Why did they push for this?
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that the initiative got going was that states began to see that the students varied quite a lot from district to district and state to state on what their standards were. In other words, states had created very different levels of expectations for their students, and they had set very different cut scores or passing scores on their tests. So there were very, very different pass rates and success rates from state to state, and there was increasing awareness that on international tests, the U.S. was a fair to middling, not real great, and we weren't looking real good.
I remember a few years ago looking back at different states and how they were doing, and it was hard to compare because the difficulty of their standardized tests varied so much. One state may look like it was doing all right, but its test was much easier than another state, which wasn't doing so well, but with a harder test.
Exactly right. And that was some of what drove it. There was some desire to figure out, well, how can we really see how well our students are doing state to state, as well as how we're doing relative to other countries? Because on the big national exam, the NAEP, which is known as the nation's report card, our kids didn't look so good as their states made them look. So there was some real skepticism about, did we really know how well our kids were doing, and a gut level feeling that they really weren't doing as well as we wanted them to do. So the idea was one uniform set of expectations, the line being, why should kids in one state or one district be held to a lower standard than kids in another?
Now,
that was what drove it.
State participation is voluntary. The last numbers we read were that 45 out of 50 have signed up. You describe the kind of, I don't know what the right word is, encouragement, or some might say coercion, whatever it may be, through funding and race to the top. Are 45 states still in the game? Some people seem to be getting cold feet. There's been a wave of criticism lately, and are 45 states still in?
Technically, yes. And you're right that this is voluntary. They can not implement these standards, and there's really no consequence for that. But there, you're right that there have been some brush fires erupting here and there, and one or two states have pulled out of the assessment consortium, meaning we still got the standards, but maybe we're not so sure about those tests. Maybe we'll do our own tests. And a couple of states have enacted legislation putting the common standards on pause, essentially. So where that goes is anyone's question in those states. There hasn't been a large-scale bailout, at least not yet.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what will happen with that. But, right, some of this has been driven by some conservative, largely conservative rhetoric about standardization and federal intrusion, federal overreach into what should be local decisions. And it's gone as far as kind of some wild rhetoric about the government using mind control and facial recognition software to get this all done. So that has gotten some people's attention, regardless of how well-founded it is.
It's been sort of under the radar for a lot of people. When are schools and students and parents likely to see this right in front of them? When's it going to show up and be very visible? How?
Well, the answer to that is it's going to vary state to state and district to district. When you mentioned the timetable, the common assessments, the tests, are due to make their debut in the spring of 2015.
Okay.
But for several years now, states and districts have been phasing in the common standards, writing curriculum for them, et cetera.
Because you have to teach it before you can test on it.
Yeah, one would hope. And that's actually been one strain of criticism, that teachers and schools have not had enough time with these very complicated standards to really be expected to be evaluated, to have teachers evaluated on them, to have schools rated on them. So that's one strain of the pushback here. But to get to your point about timing, the tests make their debut in 2015. So as to when people can see this in their schools, I would suggest that now is the time that it is showing up in most places, although there people are on very different timelines with how deeply they're getting into it at what grade level.
And when
it just varies where you are.
When the tests show up, for some states, they'll be tougher than the assessments that they they've seen at the state level so far? For some, will they be easier?
That's a good question. I certainly, for some states, they will be tougher. I would guess that for very few states, they will be easier. But, for instance, Massachusetts has been one of the poster children in this part of the debate. They've been known for very high standards, very rigorous exams, and there is a debate about whether the standards and the tests that are being designed now would be an improvement over a state like Massachusetts's old tests and standards. So certain places that did have higher standards, there's been a question, why would we go ahead and do this?
And for individual students, what are the implications, Catherine? I mean, are they going to end up with a better education, or is that clear?
None of it's clear. I mean, my job at this point is to cover something that is very still unclear after 3 years of doing this. So I think there's large swaths of the civil rights community that have advocated historically for disadvantaged children, in particular, that feel this is a great thing. The argument being, why should our kids be held to lower standards than kids in the high-flying suburbs?
Mm-hmm.
So, but these things are hard. I just spent 6 months hanging around in one classroom in one school in the District of Columbia, watching them try to put this on the ground. And the gaps between what kids know and what they're expected to know with these standards are big. And it's a heavy lift. It's going to be a heavy lift, not just in disadvantaged zones, but in the vast swaths of the country.
And it is coming down the pike right now, already working its way into schools, tests to follow. Catherine Gewirtz, assistant editor at Education Week. Thank you very much for being with us, Catherine. Appreciate it.
Sure, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this about the rise of the Common Core, the new educational testing standard rolling out into 45 of the 50 states, about to remake the way we educate and test, we're told, and now getting tested itself. There are liberal critics of this and supporters. There are conservative critics of this and supporters. Of course, some of that goes way back. Anything about centralized education is going to find resistance in some places. Texas is one of four states, along with Virginia, Alaska, Nebraska, that have not yet adopted the new Common Core standards. Texas Republican Governor Rick Perry has said the academic standards of Texas are not for sale. Here he is back in 2010 speaking to the Conservative Heritage Foundation.
I've had my moments with some of the teacher groups. But they stood up with me and said, no, we don't want Washington, D.C., in their one-size-fits-all mentality, telling us how to educate our children in the state of Texas. We don't want their national test down here. We don't want their national standards.
Rick Perry with a conservative pushback. Much more recently, Glenn Beck has taken it up. March 15th edition of his radio show and TV show, The Danger of Common Core, it was headlined. Here's Glenn Beck warning the nation against a threat to American schooling.
PTAs will have no say. You'll never be able to go to your school and say, I don't like this curriculum. What is this? What are you teaching? This doesn't work. You don't have the right to say it in your local school board because it's run nationally.
But a lot of business leaders, Republicans, and beyond the business community have said, we need this. Here's Jeb Bush, former Republican governor of Florida, a couple of weeks ago talking to the Detroit Regional Chamber of Commerce. Jeb Bush practically begging business leaders there not to let politics get in the way of the implementation of the Common Core. Jeb Bush.
If we're going to be the best country and not just talk about it, we need to actually do the work to make it happen. Higher standards is a key element of that. And these standards, the Common Core state standards, are clear and straightforward. They will allow for more innovation in the classroom, less regulation. They'll equip students to compete with their peers across the globe. Do not pull back. Please do not pull back from high, lofty standards.
Jeb Bush begging, please bring on the Common Core. Joining me now from New York City is Andrew Hacker, political scientist, public intellectual, professor emeritus in the Department of Political Science at Queens College in New York, co-author with his partner Claudia Dreyfus of an opinion piece in last Sunday's New York Times called Who's Minding the Schools, expressing plenty of skepticism about the Common Core. You can read it at our website, onpointradio.org. Andrew Hacker, welcome to On Point.
Good to be with you, Tom.
It's great to have you here. And with us from Washington, Andrew Andy Rotherham, co-founder, partner at Bellwether Education. It's a nonprofit that works to improve education for low-income students. Andrew Rotherham. Andy, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Andrew Hacker, a lot of skepticism in your essay. Why? What's got you concerned about the Common Core?
For two reasons. First, it's totally irresponsible, totally sadistic. It's going to deepen the divide in American society even further than what we have today. In addition, this was a stealth operation. No, it didn't come from the federal government. It did not come from the National Governors Association, which, what is the National Governors? It's a group that meets once a year and then goes home. This was a group of, what can you call them, educrats, who just decided they wanted to have some national standards. School superintendents, the Gates Foundation, people at the College Board, and they slipped it through. And hardly any American knows anything about it. We know more about what went on in Benghazi than we know about the Common Core.
What's wrong with national standards? I mean, why should they be all over the board? Why are national standards irresponsible or, your word, sadistic?
Well, first of all, we can talk all we want about standards. And by the way, I'm the only one that I know who has counted up the number of standards that the Common Core has. Here's my estimate. 1,386. 1,386 skills and standards, which go down in minute detail.
Is that so weird? Really. I mean, we have 12 years of education, or 13 K through 12. So what's that, like 100 a year, different things to know? Is that a lot?
Well, I could read one to you here. Represent a system of linear equations as a single matrix equation in a vector variable. That's one of the standards. And they go on. But the real issue to me is not the standards, so-called, okay, but the testing. A national test which every student from a shack in Alabama to the suburbs of Scarsdale is going to have to take. It's going to be essentially a single test. And guess what? There's going to be a huge failure rate. It's going to exacerbate the 22% dropout rate we have among high school students already.
Why shouldn't we educate the American student in a shack wherever to do just as well on a test as the student in Scarsdale? Isn't that an issue of basic equity in this country? Isn't this a good prompt to that?
Tom, with all good spirit, what you just said, I know it's not necessarily your view, is totally irresponsible. If you set this high 7-foot bar for the kid in the shack, wherever, and you keep setting the bar and you say, come on, it's rigorous, it's higher, you got to meet it, is that kid going to get over it? But it's not just one kid. We're talking about not just the 22% dropout rate, but others who manage to stay in school and are still going to be deemed non-proficient again and again in this national test. They're going to be like ex-convicts, you know, walking around without a high school diploma.
You mean it's impossible? I mean, I grew up in a little house, maybe not a shack, but in the middle of the country, middle of nowhere, some would say. Was it wrong for people to pour their effort into educating me? I don't think so.
Of course you got a good education. And
by
the
way, of course, nobody can count on it in this country. You know that.
Oh, yeah. I beg to differ here. The more I look at our nation's teachers, and I have sat in on classrooms from Michigan to Mississippi, I really have, I am impressed with the quality of teaching in our American schools, and it's a lot better, I'll say to you this, than college teaching, which I know something about. No, I think the teachers are doing a good job. Part of the evidence is my own classes at Queens College, which is a public college in a city. These are kids whose family, you know, nobody's gone to college. They're the first. They get low SAT scores. They're not Harvard material. But we work with them bit by bit. And at the end, by the time they graduate, they're ready to compete with people from Yale. Sure, we can do this, but we don't need a national test that fails so many.
And Rotherham, come in here. Everything's hunky-dory. Our education, our teachers are just fine. We don't need this. In fact, it's irresponsible, even sadistic. What do you say, Andy?
Oh, I mean, I'm not sure even how you respond to that. I have enormous respect for Professor Hacker's work, but on this issue, I mean, there's a lot of hyperbole and misinformation. I hope we can get to talking about sort of both the opportunities that are here and the risks, and there are real risks, but they're not about sadism and things like that. I mean, the standards are out there. I would encourage people to go read them. Just Google them, and you can go. So this idea that they're more secretive than Benghazi or something is ridiculous. You can go. You can read every standard. And I think reasonable people will look at them and find things that they like and they want to make sure their kids learn and things that they may think are overkill, like the example Professor Hacker just gave. But like, go take a look at like the third grade reading standards and decide, do you want to make sure that by the time your kids are in third grade, they can ask and answer questions about a text and what's in the text? They can describe characters, their motivations, why they're doing things. Is that reasonable or unreasonable in terms of teaching reading? People should go, they should read these and they should decide for themselves rather than listening to all this rhetoric. They were developed. I mean, I think two things are true. And we do a survey of sort of education influentials, and they had this same insight that I'm going to share. The standards would not have gotten to where they are without some of the support from the Obama administration, but people also think states will continue with them and are doing them despite that, and will continue even with that if that support were to go away or when that support dries up. So this is one of these things where both those things are true.
And why? What's driving that state-level focus, effort, determination, if that's what it is?
A couple of things. I mean, one thing, we're talking about these standards as if the ones we have are terrific. And there's been enormous frustration with the standards we have. I mean, I'm a former state official, and I can tell you in my state, Virginia, the only people who read the standards are the people who wrote them. It's just too much for teachers to cover. It's unwieldy. And we have pretty good standards in Virginia, by the way.
Why will this be different?
So these are sort of, and despite Professor Hacker's concern about the number of them, these are actually much leaner than what you see. And they actually made some decisions. Generally in education, you don't make decisions to exclude things from standards. It's always more and more. And that's why the standards are so unwieldy and not useful for teachers. These are much leaner. And these new assessments that are being developed, and it's not a single national test. That's inaccurate. There's two state consortia that are developing tests right now. And different states are in these different consortia. Some are actually in both. They want to see what's going to happen. And then there's some states that are going their own way. Utah, Alabama have said they're going to get tests from existing private sector vendors, and they're going to go that way to get their new tests. So there's going to end up being a multitude of tests, at least three or four, possibly more approaches. As Catherine said during the intro, this is still unfolding.
But something and much closer to standardized than we've had, where it's all over the place.
Well, the hope is how standardized it'll be remains to be seen. The hope is today's assessments, they're not as bad as people make them out to be, but they're certainly not nearly as good as our students and teachers deserve. And the hope is that this next generation of assessments, because of the research that's being put into them, the development, some federal money as well, that that's going to help develop just a better set of assessments that are going to more accurately reflect what students know, be more useful for teachers. Again, that's the hope. There's some big risks there as well.
Andrew Hacker may see some value in this, but he suggests it's outweighed by what he describes as kind of inevitable dynamic here, that you will doom a whole lot of students to being labeled failures.
You know, there's sort of two ways to look at this. One way to look at it is that the kid, as Professor Hacker said, the kid from the shack in Alabama, we just can't. That's a tough situation, and it's too bad for that kid, and their opportunities will never be the same as that kid from Scarsdale. The other way you can look at this, and this is the way I happen to look at it, is that that child from Scarsdale and does enjoy all sorts of advantages, and it is the job of the public schools to level the playing field as much as possible for that child from Alabama. And I'll just put one statistic out there that I think illustrates this. Right now in this country, about 8% of low-income students can expect to get a BA by the time they're 24. 8%. So if anyone says, well, we're doing about as well as we can't expect more, we should put these kids into voc ed, you're essentially saying that 8% is a realistic ceiling. I think that's not true. I think there's plenty of evidence from some communities that do better, schools, both public, private, and public charter schools that do better, that show we can actually have much higher expectations for students. This effort to sort of, it is essentially very small d democratic, and these are things that people like Don Hirsch of the University of Virginia have been writing about for years, to expand access to the knowledge and some of the things that those parents in Scarsdale and those kids there take for granted. That, I would argue from where I sit, that's a profoundly small d democratic impulse.
Of course, just because you set a standard doesn't mean you'll hit it. Andrew Hacker, there's a lot there. I want to come to you. Let me get a call or two in here first, if I may. Michelle in Charleston, South Carolina. Michelle, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to make a comment about, I am actually from South Carolina, which has been known as an academically poor performing state. And one of the problems that I faced was I went to college out of state.
Yeah.
And even my first job, I was working with persons who had been to, you know, Duke and Cornell and places like that. And one of the things that I found was I actually was kind of fortunate in that my district was okay,
mm-hmm.
but coming from a low performing state, it's always around you whether or not are you, you know, a high-performing student or not.
Yep.
My son right now is in the first grade, and one of the things that I wanted to answer to the professor's point is we are instituting now K-4, K-5 instruction with Common Core principles, and I see it already in my first grader. He has a lot of critical thinking,
mm-hmm.
a lot of word problems, a lot of geometric kinds of problems,
mm-hmm.
and so I think that the way that you level it is that you introduce those concepts, whether or not you have money or not, at those earlier levels, and those same students that couldn't grasp that information is being handed to them in public schools. So I actually think it is a great thing. I thought, you know, to another point, when I applied for college, I had to take an SAT
sure.
or ACT, which is also a standard test. And so no matter what my curriculum was, I was expected to score a certain amount, and that would kind of deem what college, you know, I went to.
Sure.
So I think having a set of standards is actually a help.
Michelle, I very much appreciate your call. Andrew Hacker, there's Michelle in South Carolina. She welcomes these standards and says, you know, don't leave us out. Don't imagine that we can't get up on the beam. And let's have standards that show us where to go, and we'll go there.
Absolutely. And when Michelle mentions the SAT, that's what the Common Core test will be. It's a kind of SAT level test for 50 million children starting, well, I guess, third grade is when we really start.
What's the problem with that? She says she would like to have that so that by the time she gets to the SAT, she's ready to roll, and so will be her son.
Here's one problem. With the SAT, you get a score. It goes anywhere from 200 to 800.
Yep.
With the Common Core type test, you're either proficient or unproficient, not proficient, pass or fail. And we're going to have a huge failure rate of people who are just failed. Now, one of the reasons Texas didn't go into the Common Core is that mm-hmm. Texas has three types of high school degrees, you know, and we'll just call them 1, 2, and 3. I won't even call the third the bottom one, but it doesn't have all the advanced algebra and the other trimmings in it. At the same time, if you're at that level, you're still eligible for a community college, and there, if you show your stuff, onward and upward you can go.
Yeah.
So that's fine, but you're not branded with having failed a Common Core standard.
They really don't give anything, any finer gradation on the test results than proficient or not proficient, like pass-fail, really?
Well, what we're going to have here, and by the way, I disagree with Andy when he says they're two separate tests. No, sir. There are two consortiums, but they're both going to contract with McGraw-Hill and Pearson and have common tests. In fact, I've talked with people at both Park
Pretty
and
close.
Smarter Balance, mm-hmm. which are the two consortiums, and they say we work together to get a common testing apparatus. And the reason for this is we want to compare ourselves with the Chinese and the Koreans, so we have to have a single template for the entire country.
What's wrong with that? We're competing with them whether we test or not.
Here is the bottom line on what's wrong with this.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about curriculum. We can talk about standards. But when you have this test looming over every child, every teacher, every school, you're going to teach to the test. And for all the talk about critical thinking or moral reasoning, there's not going to be that. They're going to teach test techniques, anticipating questions, how to get which of the five answers is the right one. I advise people, when they're Googling, to look at the sample questions that Common Core has on their website. Look at those sample questions and ask yourself, what do those questions really test, other than your ability to do well in tests?
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the rise of the Common Core, the new educational testing standard rolling out into 45 of the 50 states. At the end of the 24-15 academic year, lots and lots of American kids will be looking at tests built off of these almost national standards. For the first time, it's about to remake the way we educate and test. Now it's kind of getting tested itself. Andrew Rotherham is with us this hour from Washington at Bellwether Education. A nonprofit there works on improving education for low-income students. Former special assistant to the president for domestic policy in the Clinton administration. Writes the blog eduwonk.com. Andrew Hacker is with us, political scientist, professor emeritus in political science at Queens College. Wrote a big essay in the Times last Sunday, very skeptical about the Common Core. You can read it at our website, onpointradio.com. Lots of response here online. Andrew Hacker, Andy Rotherham. Brandy's in Kentucky, where they've already gotten into this, along with New York. She's a teacher from, this is on Twitter, teacher from Kentucky. Common Core brought changes in many facets I had been wanting for years. So she's all for it. Other teachers expressing fear here. Andy, let me put this one to you. Here's Anya. She says, I recently finished my student teaching at a public school. Teachers, she observes, are stressed, and they are afraid they will fail. When we see our students worried, we help them. She says, I'd ask that teachers be treated the same way. If we fail, help us. Treat us lovingly. Don't reprimand us or take away our jobs and our school's funding. Is that where this is headed, Andy?
I don't think so. I mean, states are going to take the results of these assessments, which, by the way, Professor Hacker is presenting this as if it's all done. The two consortia are going to use different methodologies to even determine what the proficient standard is. As with other standards, there'll be gradations and so forth. That's all TBD.
But people, if the tests aren't similar, it kind of defeats the purpose of a Common Core, doesn't it?
Well, and we're going to that. I think that ship has sailed. You've got states that aren't participating. You've got states that are going to contract with private sector vendors. You've got these two consortia, which, although they're collaborating on certain things, Professor Hacker said, those are things like making sure schools have enough technology to implement the tests and so forth. These are different tests. And again, this is all publicly available information. People can learn about it for themselves. A lot of that is still to be determined, and so to sort of speculate on it now before these decisions are made is irresponsible. What you're going to find with teachers, though, and I think the teacher from Kentucky shows the promise, the other teacher that you decided shows the concern, and there is a lot of concern about, will we support teachers adequately to do this? And I thought Catherine in the setup really put it well. You've got the standards, and they've been developed, and people can look at them. The assessments are being developed. In between is the curriculum for teachers, lesson plans, things like that, and people are scrambling to develop good content, because I think most people would be surprised at the low quality of a lot of lesson plans, a lot of curricula that exists now, a lot of things that people are frustrated about, a lot of stuff that's off the shelf from commercial vendors is very bland. It's not really enriching the kind of things we want kids to read.
But that raises
There's an effort to revamp that here, but it's how successful that effort will be. We've taken a look across the states at what's going on, and I think what you see sort of even in the leading states is not yet up to the scale of the challenge, and collectively around the country, the efforts really pale against the challenge here. And teachers will be, if they're not supported in this, they will end up frustrated. The teachers' unions, which currently support this, would very likely turn into adversaries. And so there's a big risk here that if we don't really over the next couple of years make a quantum leap forward in how we support teachers in doing this work, that there will be a backlash from people who currently, like the teacher in Kentucky,
support it. Well, that sounds like a roundabout version of what Andrew Hacker is saying, that we're going to have a big failure rate. Because, of course, just setting standards doesn't mean that you make the changes and the commitments, the investments to reach those standards.
So no, what Professor Hacker is saying is that this is preordained and this will just happen. What I am saying is there is a set of choices before policymakers over the next couple of years, and depending how we make those choices, we'll see how this plays out. I'm not a big fan of these sort of sweeping deterministic statements. It's simply too early to tell. This is a quantum shift in trying to think about how we support teachers, how we do standards. There's huge potential here. I mean, right now, because of all these different standards, teachers in different states can't really talk about their work at a granular level together. There's huge promise in this commonality that we're going to be able to have better ways to support teachers, more innovation and so forth. But as I said, there's tremendous risk. And the risk is that we will do what traditionally, frankly, we have done in education, which is sort of weak kinds of implementation without a lot of fidelity to the core ideas, no pun intended. Yeah. And teachers will end up unsupported and consequently frustrated.
Andrew Hacker, let me put a question to you that's coming from our website. There are many, many comments there. But here's one from John. It sounds as though he's supportive of the idea of a Common Core, of a standard across the country. And let me put his question to you. He says, what is the value of a diploma if a minimum proficiency is not achieved? Andrew Hacker?
Excellent question from John. First of all, Texas has three types of diplomas. It has the one diploma that can get you into Harvard or Yale, another diploma perhaps to San Marcos in Texas, and a third diploma where you could start at community college, maybe doing air conditioning repair, but moving up to a four-year college later. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you have a single test, for example, I have in front of me a Common Core sample question for the sixth grade, 11-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
And what's it about? Demosthenes, Daedalus, and Isthmus. Demosthenes. And you have to write a short essay, a couple of sentences, on the subject of determination. Now, okay, in the suburbs of Austin, Texas, no, sorry, Austin, Texas doesn't yes. have a Common Core, but in, say, Winnetka, Illinois,
okay.
it'll be a breeze for the 11-year-olds. Their parents have been doing schooling in this in utero. But
talking to Demosthenes, maybe. I don't know, but maybe.
Give it a try. And by the way, I'm not just talking about the shack in Alabama. Even in Winnetka in Illinois, there are two sisters. One is a math whiz. The other commits suicide over geometry tests. The math component in the Common Core is very rigorous. Algebra, more algebra, even more algebra. Wow, are we going to have a failure there?
We know not everybody's going to be a genius and not everybody's going to be straight A's. Everybody knows that. But is that an argument not to set a high standard so that we have a point to aspire to, so that the teachers across states and the U.S. in comparison with the world can compare and see how we're doing? Isn't it kind of a... What about that old soft bigotry of low expectations not to have some kind of standard to aim for? What's the problem with it?
Tom, our high schools, just to use the high schools for a moment, are already setting good standards. Winnetka, Illinois sets super high standards. Flushing High School in the borough where I teach sets high standards too.
Why not set them everywhere? Why not?
Why? Because the Common Core supporters, want to set the same test for everybody with Demosthenes for every six-year-old, and I regard that as sadistic.
Well, Tom, the professor is in a very small minority in saying that we have adequately high school standards. I think most people would disagree with that, including most state officials. Texas just went through a big, really big political fight about actually lowering some of theirs. The problem you see with these different routes, and the GED is a piece of this and so forth, is low-income kids and minority kids systematically get put into those routes. And so what you have to believe the professor's very deterministic position about this, you have to believe that poor kids and minority kids systematically, they don't want to go to elite schools. They don't want these things. They want to go and they want to be air conditioning technicians, which is, by the way, a very respectable way. And sort of if you want job security these days, there's nothing wrong with learning to work with your hands. It's a very good path to it. But you have to believe that these populations are systematically making that choice. Or you can believe, as the evidence shows, that they are systematically being put into lower tracks. They're taking less rigorous curriculum. They're then not prepared to do the things necessary to get into these elite schools. And that's why we, A, see the really poor participation of low-income kids at elite schools, and B, why we see very much of the lack of social mobility that we see, because the data is very clear on this. And Ron Haskins at Brookings has really been the leading scholar on this. The best thing you can do in this country if you want to improve social mobility is help low-income kids go to college.
And we've seen that mobility falling, and people are really worried about that. The falling
absolutely.
Behind the mobility in Europe, that's supposed to be the American promise. Let me bring our callers in. Rocky in Boston, you're on the air, Rocky. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just want to say that it is a complicated discussion. There's lots of issues.
Yes.
One thing I haven't heard talked about yet, though, is the role of parents. And I think that the existence of communicable standards can bring parents into the conversation and can ultimately help them become more advocates for schools and for teachers. And so having standards, parents can now, Professor Hackard mentioned a test item. And so now parents can actually say, what are you doing to help my child master this kind of concept, this kind of skill? And I think that's an important interesting too.
Rocky, I take your point. I remember when my kids were in primary school, it was very hard to know if they were learning what they needed to learn or not. I mean, who knows? You go, you sit down with the teacher, but who knows? I appreciate your call. Let me get one more here from Hopkinsville, Kentucky, where they are already into the Common Core era. Sally's calling. Hi, Sally, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi. Well, I've experienced it. I have three children. One's a junior in high school, a senior, and a junior in college.
Okay.
And we experienced this in elementary school. My oldest daughter went all the way through public school. My younger two went through part of middle school for public school, and then we switched to private school.
Okay.
What I found was that, you know, the teachers have a tough job. They mean well. They're trying to do their job and teach, but they also have to teach to the test. And that testing, that teaching to the test started at the beginning of the school year. They were tested. The kids were tested midway in the semester. They were tested in December. They were tested in January. Then they had 2 weeks of prepping for the test, which was the actual test in April.
So did that give them a good education or just get them focused on testing?
Absolutely not. No, because they were teaching to the test. They had to, and yes, we got the distinguished, the proficient, the under proficient.
Yep.
And what did you do with that? What's done with that for each student? Nothing. You start the beginning of the next school year, and you're just tested. And the teachers are graded, are based on, and the schools are graded on how the kids perform on the test.
That's supposed to motivate them. Did you see them motivated by that?
No, they were sick of it. They hated it. You know, I was like, oh, we're teaching to the test again. We can't do this because we have to practice test questions. In their writing portfolio, my son, who's a very talented writer, when he was in fourth grade, the guidance, and he wrote a great letter. I don't do their work. They have to do their work.
Yep.
I proofed it.
Yep.
And he rewrote it, and the guidance counselor proofed his work and rewrote it herself. She didn't have him rewrite it. So the teachers have to, you know, they're graded on it. The school is graded on their performance of the kids.
Yeah.
And when you end up with that proficiency, you know, what does it mean? What is going to happen for that individual student?
Sally, I can see if it doesn't have the sort of meat on the bones, it could be disturbing. I appreciate your call from Kentucky. Let me get a call here from, we'll come to that, Sally. Let me get Michael on here from Augusta, Georgia. Michael, you're on.
Hey, Tom. Interesting topic.
Good.
First, I did have one question. Does the Common Core in any way, can it eliminate any of the bureaucracy that's been going on in schools and education? I mean, we're the highest spending nation on earth, and primarily it goes to oversight as far as where the money goes. Secondly, I wanted to give an opinion that I think, in general, Common Core is a great idea for elementary and middle school children with much higher standards than we currently have. Children are sponges. But I think it's the wrong idea for high schoolers. In high school, with parental approval, if a child wants to take auto mechanics all day long and come out of high school being excellent at what they do, or if they want to take art all day long and come out of high school being excellent at what they do, I think that that's the better program. Some people know what they want long before college, and if they can come out with the experiences necessary, then they can follow through with it without ever having to go to college. We could immediately have productive individuals as
Michael, let me pick those up, and I appreciate your call from Augusta. Andy Rotherham, how about it? First, anything in here that makes schools more efficient? And second, what about those kids who, you know, Andrew Hacker's really thinking about, who maybe don't want to go to college and want to go in a different direction? Does this cut their freedom to get focused earlier?
So on the point on spending, actually, most money doesn't go to oversight. Most money actually goes to teachers, and that's understandable because education is a labor-intensive field. In terms of efficiency, yes, having a clearer set of expectations for what we expect here has the potential to help with efficiency if we act on those data, we make good decisions, and so forth. On the larger question, I think it's actually the high school question. It's a really excellent question, and reasonable people disagree about this. Here's the thing to think about. You know, some people do know what they want to do at a relatively young age. Many don't. And you can think about many people whose own life experiences and trajectories, they went in different directions. And so, again, different people disagree, but where I come down is you want high schools to essentially be trampolines to push kids to higher levels of learning and have lots of different choices in front of them. And so my concern is that kid who really thinks they want to do cars and they're really good at that and that's what they do through high school. And then a couple of years later, they decide, you know what, they don't want to do that for the next 40 years after they've been out and doing it. You want to have that kid set up, and this is not a hypothetical example. I know kids like this in rural communities. You want that kid to be set up to then go back to college, go back to community college, to go on a different path. And if we just let kids specialize in high school and make them purely vocational, you're essentially putting people on a pretty fixed path that it then becomes harder and harder to bounce back from. They decide they want to go to college. They're way far back from even taking credit-bearing college courses, for example. And so I really think, and you can blend these things. There's absolutely nothing in the Common Core that's incompatible with a terrific program in auto mechanics and shop. You can do these things. Good schools do this now. The gentleman was from Augusta. There's a gentleman in Georgia, Gene Bottoms, who's done just terrific work on this over the years. And you get really good outcomes when you combine rigorous academics with vocational education. So it's not a choice. But we really do want to think about how do you give kids choice.
Yeah.
We are indeed. Is it a done deal, Andrew Hacker? And where do you think it takes us?
First of all, what I'd say is, if you talk about the money end, part of what's going to be is that these tests are all going to be sitting with kids at keyboards in front of computer screens, all 50 million of them. This is the aim of Common Core, is to get rid of pencil and paper. Imagine what it's going to cost to put in the computerized ability to have 50 million kids take a test in the same week. My goodness. You say all money's going to teachers? No, it'll be going to Apple and Microsoft and
in the 21st century, shouldn't we have computers out there in the schools for that?
Sure, that's what we want. A group of students who are techno test savvy. Is that what we want? Well, that's what we'll get.
Well, we may get it, and we may get it soon. Common Core is coming. Andrew Hacker at Queens College, thank you for being with us today. Andrew Rotherham at Bellwether Education in Washington, thank you to you both. And to all our listeners and callers, thanks as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.